And all that I know is blowing like tumbleweed.
And I thought if he breaks through and gains access, he will come row by row and shoot us.
Survivors of the mass shooting at a Minneapolis church recalled the terror and moments of courage that took place that day.
For Friday, August 29th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Food and Drug Administration has approved the next round of COVID-19 vaccines, but there are restrictions on who is eligible to get vaccinated.
There's now going to be much more confusion and distrust of vaccines among the public.
And President Trump boasts that he's brokered an increasing number of peace agreements and ceasefires.
But in reality, the situation is less clear.
All these different conflicts that he's taking credit for, some of them are not even over. Others of them, are very brittle.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said today he's appointing Russ Vogt to lead what's left of the U.S. Agency for International Development. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, Vogt already leads the Office of Management and Budget and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Secretary Rubio announced Vogt's new role in a Truth Social post, saying he would oversee the closeout of USAID's remaining programs. Earlier this year, President Trump appointed Rubio to lead the aid agency, which was effectively dismantled. The few programs that remain merged with the State Department in July. Vogt's new job comes as the White House moves to eliminate nearly $5 billion in funds already appropriated by Congress, some of which went to USAID. The move effectively goes around Congress's power over the purse and is considered illegal by many lawmakers. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott approved a new congressional map that could help Republicans gain up to 5 additional seats in the House next year. The Texas Newsroom's Lucio Vasquez has more.
Abbott signed the bill into state law, approving a map designed to favor Republicans at President Trump's request. The redrawn districts could flip several seats from Democratic to GOP control in the 2026 midterms. The measure passed along party lines after Democrats fled the state in protest, returning only after California lawmakers pledged to pass their own map to offset Republican gains. Critics say the new map dilutes the voting power of minority communities in major Texas cities. Federal lawsuits have already been filed. I'm Lucio Vasquez in Houston.
In a federal court in Washington, D.C. today, Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa Cook's attempt to temporarily block President Trump from firing her ended with the judge not issuing a ruling. This after 2 hours of oral arguments. Trump has suggested Cook committed mortgage fraud, and his Federal Housing Finance Agency Director, Bill Pulte, has now made a second criminal referral to the Justice Department against Cook. Trump wants the board to cut interest rates as his tariffs take effect and has threatened to fire Fed Chair Jerome Powell if he doesn't do so, but so far both the board and Powell have resisted the pressure. Mike Reagan is managing editor of Bloomberg News.
Is meant to be basically an independent agency. You know, the president can appoint people to the board, but, once they're appointed, they're supposed to be able to make decisions on their own without any political interference from the president or anyone else.
Speaking there on NPR's Here and Now, the Federal Reserve Act says a president can only remove a Fed governor for cause, but precisely what cause is hasn't yet been established. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. President Trump has revoked former Vice President Kamala Harris's Secret Service protection. Now, typically, former vice presidents only get that protection for 6 months after they leave office, but former President Biden gave her an extension. It's the extension that Trump is revoking. This as she heads out on a nationwide book tour for her new book, 107 Days, about her historically short run for president last year. Gasoline prices are up slightly heading into this holiday weekend. According to AAA, the national average is now just over $3.20. But as NPR's Camila Domonoske reports, they're expected to trend down soon.
Overall, gasoline prices have been remarkably steady this summer. Throughout May, June, and July, the national average stayed within a few pennies of $3.15. More recently, flooding at a refinery in Indiana caused a spike in gasoline prices, especially in Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan, according to the app Gas Buddy. But the refinery has restarted operations, and both Gas Buddy and AAA expect prices to ease down again. Gasoline prices have been low and steady this summer in large part because of calm crude oil prices. The OPEC Plus oil cartel has been pushing more barrels of oil onto the market. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Core inflation edged higher last month, according to the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation measure. The Commerce Department says its Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index shows core inflation rose to 2.9%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. Weather tonight, partly cloudy with highs 50 to 57 degrees, calm winds. Tomorrow, patchy fog early, then mostly sunny.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Every once in a while, you want to splurge. One of the editors of this show has been in that mood. She's been eyeing this shirt from a company that's in the UK. It's this white button-down with khaki green stripes. And yeah, it's a little pricey, but it is so her. But she's confused about whether she can buy it. That's because of an executive order stripping away what's known as de minimis exemptions. It goes into effect today, a change that is expected to increase the price of imported goods and disrupt international shipping. Peter Evis is a business reporter with the New York Times. He's been covering all of this and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Peter, if we can, let's start with the de minimis exemption. Tell us, how did it work?
It allowed you to buy an item overseas and bring it into the United States without paying tariffs or doing any sort of complicated customs paperwork, as long as that item or as long as that shipment was worth $800 or less.
And now that it's gone, for all intents and purposes, how does that change things for American consumers?
I mean, if you were a big purchaser of goods from overseas, you will probably see the prices of some of the items that you buy rise. That's because the seller is factoring in the tariffs, and there may also be extra shipping costs because the carrier that's bringing those goods into the country has more to do now and may charge you for that. In fact, that's what I'm hearing from a lot of people, that they're getting quite expensive bills from the express carriers like DHL or FedEx or UPS.
How has the Trump administration justified this change?
They say, and also Democrats support this as well, they say that it had allowed for unfair trade to take place. They said that businesses had exploited this exemption to bring in goods without paying tariffs. And they also said that this channel was being used for the smuggling of fentanyl.
Now, in your reporting for the New York Times, you point to something of a test case. The exemption was eliminated for China and Hong Kong first earlier this year. What have you learned from that example? And does what you're seeing there support the Trump administration's stated goals?
Great question. There has been a drop-off in the number of transactions that American shoppers have been doing with some of the biggest sellers of Chinese goods. You've probably heard of companies like Shein,
right,
or Temu. Transactions at those companies fell off a cliff in May. Interestingly, though, Shein's has completely, not completely, but largely recovered. And the Trump administration also said yesterday that they have collected nearly $500 million in tariffs on goods from China and Hong Kong that otherwise would have been tariff-free before the exemption went away in May. So there are some developments that would support some of the things that the Trump administration had hoped for, i.e. Tariff collection, and also that trade wouldn't completely collapse.
Now, small business owners abroad are going to have to decide whether to pass the tariff costs off to American buyers or to absorb them themselves. But they also might have to rethink how they ship goods, right?
Exactly. So one of the wrinkles to all this is that if you were buying goods overseas, and a lot of people do this through Etsy and eBay, and then you were having them shipped by the International Postal Network. Now, that's, you know, the Royal Mail sending it to the USPS, United States. It is not FedEx. It is not UPS. And when you do it that way, it's a much cheaper method of shipping. But a big change occurred today. Before, the package would be sent by the mail to the United States. Customs would assess it for any duties. And then if there were duties to pay on that, you would have to go to the post office and pay them to get your package. That no longer exists. What happens now is that the foreign post office has to collect the duties before sending it and then try and get that money over to the United States. Most of them don't have any sort of like payment facility like that up and running. And so they have suspended shipping for the time being until they get that sorted out.
Now, I want to take us back to where we started this conversation, which is about my colleague and the shirt that she keeps talking about. In a nutshell, what should our editor consider as she thinks about whether to buy it, given everything you've just laid out here?
Well, I would definitely look for any sign that they had put up prices to, take into account the tariffs, first of all, and then say to herself, okay, that's too much or not. And then I would just also check what's happening with shipping. Now, if it's going to come in on an express carrier, that might add even more to the cost of it and make the purchase unattractive. But if it's coming in on the postal network, she may not even be able to get it because the seller will have learned that the Royal Mail can't actually get the package to the United States until it sets up the payment infrastructure, which we just talked about.
That's New York Times business reporter Peter Eavis. His latest piece for the New York Times is "A Tariff Loophole on Cheap Imports is Closed. How Will It Affect Shoppers?" Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Before he entered politics, most Americans knew Donald Trump as an entertainer, as the host of the hit show The Apprentice. He was catapulted to a new level of fame.
I've mastered the art of the deal and have turned the name Trump into the highest quality brand. And as the master, I want to pass along my knowledge to somebody else. I'm looking for The Apprentice.
That persona has carried over to Trump's political life as he embraces his role as entertainer-in-chief. In this term, unlike the first, Trump has taken aim at cultural institutions. He initiated a takeover of the Kennedy Center, has declared that Smithsonian exhibits must submit to White House scrutiny, and he has successfully sued and won settlements from multiple broadcasting giants. For a look at how President Trump is reshaping culture, we're joined now by NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro and NPR cultural critic and media analyst Eric Dagans. Hey to both of you.
Hey there.
Hey.
Hey, so let's start with you, Eric. And it's a big first question. What kind of direct impact do you think the president's interjection into culture has had on the arts? Like, what's most jumped out to you?
So I think what we've seen happen here is a lot of chaos, and we've also seen a lot of uncertainty and a lot of fear. People are not sure what's expected of them, but what seems to be happening is that the expertise of people who've run these institutions is being subverted and overturned and replaced by fealty to Trump and his ideological agenda. And on top of that, what's really interesting is that even though Trump has in many ways been somebody who's overturned institutions, he's also somebody who wants to be recognized by them. You know, he's somebody who has called the press fake news, but he also seems to want to be featured in, you know, the New York Times or featured favorably in CNN. He's someone who has criticized the Kennedy Center honors, but he's also someone who seems to want to receive one. And in fact, we saw that when he was talking about the Kennedy Center honors and picking who would get them as he began to assert more control over the organization. And we have a clip.
Since 1978, the Kennedy Center honors have been among the most prestigious awards in the performing arts. I wanted one. I was never able to get one. This year, it's true, actually. I would have taken it if they would have called me. I waited and waited and waited. And I said, the hell with it. I'll become chairman.
And so I think what, you know, really concerns people in the arts world is that all of a sudden the rubric isn't whether you're a great artist or whether you've achieved something. It's, you know, how much have you paid fealty to Trump and how much do you align with his ideology?
Well, Domenico, this assertion of authority we're seeing from President Trump this term, it's more than we saw in the first term, right? Like, how unusual is this level of involvement in the cultural space for a president?
Well, we've always had presidents try to look to shape the narrative. You know, all the way back to Nixon, his vice president, Spiro Agnew, spoke out against the advent of television news, for example, which he saw as shallow and focused on the wrong things. But what Trump is doing here goes way beyond any traditional working of the refs. You know, he's trying to use the leverage of his office to operationalize control over the message. He's trying, for example, to force media outlets' hands, and more specifically, their corporate owners, often with lawsuits or, in the case of public media, cutting funding. You know, Trump doesn't want criticism. He wants fealty, and he's willing to use whatever he can to get it.
Fealty. Okay, so if this is all about loyalty, something that we know he values, why take on an industry that often challenges authority just to show he can do it?
That's exactly why, you know, to try and break it, to get that control over them. And, you know, to do this in some ways with outlets settling for millions of dollars for things that are routine journalistic practice, as CBS did as a result of 60 Minutes editing of an interview with Kamala Harris during the 2024 campaign. It was a real strong arm tactic.
And it's been interesting to see how the pushback has come within the same company that owns CBS and 60 Minutes, Paramount. South Park seems to be enemy show, seems to be where there's a lot of criticism of the president, even as there was a deal a deal between South Park and Paramount, and a deal between Paramount and Skydance to merge. They have stepped forward. They've had new episodes that have criticized the president. And we've got a clip of them making fun of how the president tends to bring in world leaders or bring in local politicians and have them flatter him. Let's check it out.
Mr. President, you have so many great ideas. Your leadership is truly beyond anything we have ever had in this country.
And we have to stop there because the joke that unfolds is something we can't air on the radio. But it's worked for South Park because, you know, they're coming from a place where they haven't necessarily always been a consistent critic of the president, but they're stepping up now, and it's really making an impact.
Yeah, and if you think that's outlandish, I mean, listen to just a little bit of Trump's recent 3.5-hour cabinet meeting.
Under the last administration, and it's an honor to do this under your leadership.
Have innovative jobs and get them back to work. So thank you for your leadership, Mr. President.
Thank you. Great job, Russ.
Mr. President, I invite you to see your big, beautiful face on a banner in front of the Department of Labor.
Because so is that life imitating art or vice versa? Either way, this is what Trump wants. And certainly with an industry like comedy or the arts that are traditionally counterculture and counterpower.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro and Eric Deggans. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phonology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. We receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure, with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. Now for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, August 29, 2011, I spot a morning cloak butterfly, and it looks magnificent. This is an emerging butterfly of the fall. It has spent the summer as a first an egg and then a caterpillar, and then it metamorphosed into this lovely dark brown, nearly black butterfly with the cream-colored border and blue dots on the back wing if you get close enough to see them. But the morning cloak is interesting for another reason. This particular butterfly is going to find a spot, maybe a pile of lumber behind your house, maybe some crevice in your garage, maybe a crack in a tree. But that butterfly is going to crawl into that hiding place and spend the winter, and it will freeze solid. But it does so in a way that is referred to as supercooling. And if it doesn't over a long and slow period, the freezing of its body won't injure the tissue. And the thing will emerge in spring, usually in late March or early April on a very nice warm spring day. You'll see this same morning cloak butterfly crawl out of its hiding spot and begin to fly about. So in the fall, appreciate their beauty and understand that they have but a brief period to eat and gain some nourishment in order to basically freeze to death until next spring.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing the number 27-MEDICARE. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Last night, the White House informed Congress that it plans to cut almost $5 billion that lawmakers had already approved for foreign aid. The White House used a rare maneuver called a pocket rescission. That's when the government's request comes so late that Congress doesn't have enough time to vote on it before the end of the fiscal year. NPR's Gabriella Emanuel joins me now. Welcome.
Hi there.
Hi. So this is $5 billion that the administration wants to effectively cancel. Its money that was already appropriated by Congress. Tell us, what was the money meant for?
What we know is the money was going for things like UN peacekeepers and development assistance. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said programs being canceled also include LGBTQ awareness efforts. But people who do development and humanitarian aid say they do not know the specific programs that would be cut. But what we do know is it's a lot of money in the aid world, and it would have a big impact.
Well, the Trump administration has already cut billions in foreign aid this year, including dismantling the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. Tell us where these cuts fit into the picture.
Well, it is all part of the administration's ongoing effort to dramatically change the face and footprint of U.S. foreign aid. But it is also part of a battle over who controls the money in Washington. I spoke with Mitchell Warren, executive director of AVAC. They're an HIV prevention group that sued the administration earlier this year to release appropriated funds. He says this latest move isn't really about foreign aid.
This is not about foreign assistance or about HIV and AIDS or any aspect of global health. This is fundamentally about who controls the federal budget.
And constitutionally, it is very clear that Congress holds the power of the purse. But this administration has been really pushing the bounds of this balance of power.
Now, last month, we had a really similar situation. There was a rescission package from the White House that was requesting the clawback of billions of dollars in foreign aid funds that had already been approved by lawmakers. But there's something different about this time, right?
That's right. So last month, lawmakers had the required 45 days to consider the request. They voted on it and approved it. The key difference here is the timing. This rescission is happening so close to the end of the fiscal year when the funds are scheduled to expire that Congress doesn't have enough time to have a final say. The U.S. Government Accountability Office says these pocket rescissions are illegal since the president does not hold the power of the purse.
What have lawmakers had to say about this?
Well, there's been bipartisan frustration at the Trump administration for this move. Republican Senator Susan Collins, for example, called this tactic, quote, a clear violation of the law. Collins is the chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee, and she laid out that there is a standard way to do rescissions, and this isn't it.
Is the administration concerned at all that this pocket rescission won't go through?
Yes. A White House official who spoke to reporters on the condition of anonymity today said they expect there could be litigation in court around this, and they feel well prepared to defend the use of a pocket rescission.
NPR's Gabriella Emanuel, thank you.
Thank you.
This week, the Food and Drug Administration approved the next round of COVID-19 vaccines, but imposed new restrictions on who is eligible to get vaccinated. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the health secretary, has spent years challenging established science around vaccine safety. As John Daly reports from Denver, that has some states, like Colorado, seeking out their own vaccine guidance.
Each state has its own laws establishing what vaccinations are required for school-age children. Most of these vaccine schedules are similar because the states look to recommendations coming from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for guidance. But earlier this year, Secretary Kennedy fired and replaced every member of the vaccine advisory panel that guides the CDC by developing recommendations on how vaccines are used in the U.S. Doctors and vaccine scientists were alarmed, like Dr. Allison Kemp.
There's now going to be much more confusion and distrust of vaccines among the public.
Kemp is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado who served on that advisory panel years ago. She worries the new panelists will fall in line with Kennedy, who worked for years as an anti-vaccine activist. His agency is already narrowing some of the guidance for who should get COVID-19 vaccines this year over the objections of key physician groups. Democratic lawmakers in Colorado anticipated Kennedy's moves, and they took action.
You could see the writing on the wall that it was just becoming overly politicized rather than relying on actual science with this new HHS director.
That's State Senator Kyle Mulica, a Democrat who's also an ER nurse. He co-sponsored a new law that tells the State Board of Health it may look to scientific sources beyond the CDC when putting together its vaccine recommendations for state residents. The health board can now also consult with leading medical groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
We decided to protect Colorado and make sure that, you know, in Colorado that we wouldn't be as vulnerable to political upheaval that we're seeing right now.
The democratically controlled legislature passed the bill on a party line vote, and Democratic Governor Jared Polis signed it. Republicans voted against it, but declined an interview request. Another co-sponsor of the bill, State Representative Lindsey Gilchrist, a Democrat, says there's so much false information circulating about vaccines, including for COVID-19, so it's important to hear from top medical experts.
Especially around disease control and immunization policy, we need to be really clear.
Dr. David Higgins is a pediatrician at the University of Colorado who helped craft the bill.
Colorado, I think, really is leading the way on this.
Higgins says other states like Massachusetts, Maine, Pennsylvania, and Michigan are exploring similar ideas, like removing references to the federal vaccine panel or trying to protect vaccine access. In an email responding to NPR's request for comment, HHS Press Secretary Emily G. Hilliard pointed NPR to a statement Kennedy posted on X, in which he said the new panel members are, quote, committed to evidence-based medicine, gold standard science, and common sense. Meanwhile, Kemp, the pediatrician, says she's glad Colorado is actively forging ahead with its own recommendations.
I think in Colorado, we really are pretty protected.
The rift between the federal government and outside vaccine experts has already begun to play out. While the Food and Drug Administration moved to further restrict access to this year's COVID vaccine, the American Academy of Pediatrics is recommending that kids under 23 months get the shot. For NPR News, I'm John Daly in Denver.
This story comes from NPR's reporting partnership with Colorado Public Radio and KFF Health News.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station. This is NPR.
This is NPR News.
It is 429, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We received support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde, available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Registration is now open for the Itasca Orchestra Youth Strings Program. Classes begin September 15th. Learn more and register at itascaorchestra.org. And we receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A tearful and emotional reunion took place recently in Manitoba. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a Scoop survivor was reunited with his Indigenous family after 50 years.
Jonathan Hooker was taken from his family in 1975. He was 2 months old. He is from the Mosakahiken Cree Nation in northern Manitoba. His new middle-class white family moved to New Zealand when he was 18 months old. Hooker always knew he was adopted but was never able to locate his birth mother. That is, until an ancestry test, which led him to make contact with his half-sister who lives in Texas.
So hopefully somebody else, again, from will see this and hopefully maybe start looking for their family or it'll give them some clues to reach out and help.
Hooker had tried to find his natural family a few years ago on a visit to Canada, but without success. This time he was embraced by his biological mother, Patsy George, when he arrived at the airport in Winnipeg.
I thought I would never see him again. He was only 2 months old when they took him away from me. And my other daughter, a month old.
George also recently found out that Hooker was married and had children. She said she would see her grandchildren one day. It's believed that about 300,000 Indigenous children were taken from their homes in a government operation known as the 60s Scoop. Many were placed with non-Indigenous families across Canada and around the world. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A haunting crime story and an Alaska Native legend are at the center of a new documentary that will premiere on the streaming platform Hulu next month. Ayulna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more on the film, which is called Blood and Myth.
Blood and Myth looks into a real-life crime case that happened in Northwest Alaska over a decade ago. James Domick Jr. is the executive producer of the new documentary.
It's just an incredible story of survival and legends and violence and culture.
Domick worked at KNBA for 3 years, starting in 2016. During his time there, a co-worker asked him if he knew any Alaska stories that would make a good podcast. Domick told him about Teddy Kyle Smith, an Inupiaq actor from Kayana. In 2012, troopers were investigating the suspicious death of his mother when Smith fled to a cabin and had a violent encounter with two hunters. He was later convicted of attempted murder. Smith said that Inukuns, or little people, guided his actions. Domick described the incident in his 2019 audiobook called Midnight Sun. The new Hulu documentary is a movie adaptation of the audiobook. Domick grew up in Kotzebue hearing about the little people, creatures that exist in various legends from Inuit groups across the globe.
If all of us had the same story and we're all so spread out, it might have air of truth to it.
In the film, Domick says he also wanted to highlight the issue of justice in rural Alaska, where the state struggles to provide a consistent law enforcement presence. Domick says that Blood and Myth is a true crime documentary told through an Indigenous perspective, which is rare in today's entertainment industry.
This is the type of story I wanted to see, and no one was making it. So I made it for me. Everyone else is invited to listen and watch. But at the end of the day, it's something I made for me.
Domick has worked in film production, but being an executive producer in his own film is a first for him. He says he wondered if it was his story to tell, but decided to do it after talking to his family and elders in his community. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez. We'll be right back.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Minutes from downtown Anchorage, the Alaska Native Heritage Center is more than a museum. It's where Alaska Native traditions, languages, and arts come alive. There's always something new at the Alaska Native Heritage Center who support this show. More at alaskanative.net.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. We're going to go to Minneapolis now, where people have been gathering at Annunciation Catholic Church for the past 2 days after the mass shooting there. NPR's Vanessa Romo has been talking to people who have come by to pay their respects, and also to people who were inside the church that horrific day. She joins us now to tell us what she's been hearing in those conversations. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Elsa.
So if I may, I want to start with one woman in particular, whom I understand you spoke with. She told you that she was inside the church when the attack unfolded. Like, how does she describe what happened?
Well, I spoke with Catherine Spandel, and I think we should just hear directly from her.
Mass had just begun. We had had the opening hymn. We had just finished the psalm, and the gunshots rang out.
Spandel told me that she not only grew up in the neighborhood, she's an alum of Annunciation School. She graduated in 1973, and she was at the church Wednesday morning because she's on the planning committee for a big festival that the church holds in September. They were supposed to meet after the mass, so when she heard the gunshots, her first thought was that it was fireworks. She said a sort of prank. And then when she realized it wasn't, she dove for the floor, and as bullets flew above the pews, she reached out for the pastoral minister's hand.
She was facing me, and we reached towards each other, and we prayed the Hail Mary together, and we were both crying. I thought, if he breaks through and gains access, he will come row by row and shoot us.
And Elsa, although she says he, police identified the shooter as Robin Westman, who had undergone a name change in 2019.
I mean, all of this sounds so incredibly terrifying.
Yes. Catherine Spandel said that she thought she was going to die, and she told me that she was only four pews behind the little boy who was killed.
Oh, my God. Well, we now know the identity of both of the students who were killed. What can you tell us about them?
The little boy was 8-year-old Fletcher Merkel. His father, Jesse Merkel, really wants him to be remembered for who he was in life, a little boy who loved fishing and cooking and all sports. The other child was 10-year-old Harper Moisky. Her parents said that she was someone whose laughter and kindness and spirit touched everyone who knew her, especially her little sister, who adored Harper.
Heartbreaking. Well, many others were injured, at least 18 people, most of them children. What do we know about their condition now?
We know that one child is in critical condition in the hospital, and we know that one adult is in serious condition, and at least four others are still hospitalized. One of the children is Sophia Forchus, who was seriously wounded. Her family is Greek Orthodox, and their parish held a service last night to pray for her recovery. Sophia's father made a brief statement to the congregation saying that she's still in the hospital and has undergone surgery, and that she will likely get worse before she gets better. And hundreds of people came to that service to show their support. And even today, you see it here at Annunciation, where I am right now. There are buckets and buckets of flowers and balloons and teddy bears. The entire community is mourning, trying to come to grips with this tragedy. One of them is Scott Berger, who came by with his 7-year-old daughter, and she's starting second grade at a nearby public school. He told me he doesn't know how anyone is going to be able to send their kids to school next week. He seemed really stunned by the shooting. He said, if it can happen here, it can happen anywhere.
That is NPR's Vanessa Romo in Minneapolis. Thank you so much, Vanessa.
You're welcome, Elsa.
As he struggles to end war in Ukraine, President Trump has turned to boasting of reaching an ever-increasing number of peace agreements and ceasefires in other parts of the world.
We've stopped 7 wars, and really the number is actually 10.
But NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez says the reality of those peace agreements is not so black and white.
During the campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump would say in interview after interview that he would end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours. Here he is on Fox News back in 2023.
And there's a very easy negotiation to take place, but I don't want to tell you what it is because then I can't use that negotiation. It'll never work.
But whatever he tried, it didn't work as President Trump ran into the harsh realities of governing and diplomacy. Trump's, of course, not one to focus on his struggles. So a few months into his administration, Trump turned to touting his efforts to end other conflicts.
On Saturday, my administration helped broker a full and immediate ceasefire, I think a permanent one, between India and Pakistan, ending a dangerous conflict of two nations with lots of nuclear weapons.
Lisa Curtis, a point person on South and Central Asia during the first Trump administration, says Trump deserves credit for the ceasefire between India and Pakistan.
This was absolutely critical. Anytime you have two nuclear-armed countries in conflict, there is tremendous concern that it would escalate to the point of a nuclear exchange.
And while India contradicted the U.S. version of events, Curtis sees the May agreement as a turning point for Trump in how he looks at applying U.S. influence around the world.
I think when he saw, well, actually, the U.S. can play an influential role and, you know, I can get credit for, you know, trying to stop some of these conflicts, I think, a light bulb went off.
It was a start of an evolution, as Curtis put it, that surprised a lot of people in diplomatic circles.
I love that President Trump wants to evaluate himself and have others do so by this particular metric.
Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, notes that most people associate Trump's America First policies with isolationism and kind of an indifference to other countries' challenges. And yet, while he credits Trump with having a positive influence on several of these conflicts, O'Hanlon says the administration is largely exaggerating its role.
All these different conflicts that he's taking credit for, some of them are not even over. Others of them, you know, are very brittle in whatever peace may be taking shape. And still others, he had very modest roles in influencing, if any.
Trump and his team have cited his work around the world when advocating for the Nobel Peace Prize. Trump's chief envoy, Steve Witkoff, this week called Trump's efforts game-changing.
There's only one thing I wish for, that Nobel Committee finally gets its act together and realizes that you are the single finest candidate.
Experts say Trump deserves credit for reducing tensions between Thailand and Cambodia, as well as Armenia and Azerbaijan. But fighting continues in the Democratic Republic of Congo, even after a peace agreement between the DRC and Rwanda, which Trump hailed as a, quote, glorious triumph for the cause of peace.
You know, peace has not broken out.
That's Michelle Gavin, a former U.S. ambassador to Botswana during the Obama administration. Sometimes it helps to announce agreements that can be used to apply pressure on the parties involved. But she says this feels like the Trump administration is prioritizing the announcement of a peace deal before peace actually arrives.
I'm very glad that this administration is not ignoring the crisis in Central Africa, but it just seems like a real race to declare mission accomplished before the hard work has been done.
And she wonders whether this administration has the appetite for the dogged diplomacy that she says is required to make sure these announcements are fulfilled. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeSingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Listen Saturdays at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. for She Rose Radio, amplifying female voices and music with Carmel Holt. This week is an encore presentation of an interview with Jensen McCray. Bovee Farmers Day celebration is now through Monday, September 1st. Activities include a library book sale, live music, and a parade Monday at 11 a.m. The next Summer Muse Festival is Saturday, August 30th from 4 to 8 at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji, with artists, musicians, food vendors, and more. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series Thursday, September 4th at noon. This month, learn about stormwater runoff and the problems it can cause. Register at itascawaters.org. Now it's time for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, why things may seem a little different the next time you visit the state capitol. Then, a look at the new technologies and regulations for airport travelers. And a big boost for food shelves in central Minnesota. I'm Chantel Sings. You'll have fewer doors to choose from the next time you try and enter the Minnesota State Capitol. The Department of Public Safety has announced new safety measures at the Capitol, including fewer public entrances and more security officers at the entrances. The additional security comes in response to the assassination of Speaker Emerita Hortman, threats by a lobbyist, and security finding a naked man in the Senate chamber when the building was supposed to be closed. The State Patrol is conducting a security assessment and consulting with the Sergeant at Arms and state lawmakers to determine if additional safety changes are needed. In today's main story, as the summer travel season ramps up, we take a look at what regular and new travelers should know about changes in security regulations. Jamad Jama has more.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are currently
Navigating the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, or MSP, can feel stressful. And with new technology and procedures, it's a good time for a refresher on how to easily move through the Transportation Security Administration checkpoint, also known as TSA.
We have been upgrading technology at MSP and airports across the country over the past several years. One is called our credential authentication technology. A real-time photo of you is taken and compared against the picture on your ID.
That's Jessica Maley, a regional spokesperson for the TSA. That real-time photo is part of new security measures to speed things up, but travelers can opt out and have a TSA officer manually verify their identity instead. And this isn't the only recent change at the airport.
No one has to remove their shoes anymore. It is a policy in effect nationwide. It's for all passengers, pre-check and standard. That's been really received well by the passengers. People really appreciate that.
And for those who haven't flown lately, the Real ID requirements may be a bit confusing.
So we began enforcement of Real ID on May 7th. It has gone really smoothly so far. There are about 8 or 10 other forms of acceptable ID. So it might be a Real ID. It might be a passport. Make sure you're bringing something that will work.
That could mean a veteran health ID card or a permanent resident card. Check the full list at tsa.gov before you head to the airport. But beyond these new updates, how you pack can make all the difference.
First of all, it starts at home. So take a few minutes while you're packing. Go through your bag. We always say unpack before you pack. Take everything out of the bag and then put back in what you need.
Being mindful of what you're packing in your bag is key to avoiding any delays at security. For liquids, stick to travel-sized containers of 3.4 ounces or less in your carry-on, and they must be in a clear, quart-sized, resealable bag. Anything larger will have to be checked.
Tools have to be 7 inches or less. Scissors have to be 4 inches or less. They are on the website, so tsa.gov, and kind of check if you are not sure.
Firearms have strict rules, too. They must be unloaded, locked in a hard-sided container, and in checked baggage, as well as declared with your airline when checking the bag. It's also your responsibility to know the firearm laws of your destination. For those who travel often, staying ahead of travel security changes becomes a habit. Frequent flyer Elijah James, a business consultant who flies out of MSP often, also has some tips.
TSA has become second nature to me at this point. I'd say the biggest thing is preparing and knowing what is and isn't allowed.
And that way, by the time he gets to the security line, things feel less stressful.
And honestly, it comes down to the little things, like making sure to pack your liquids right, having your ID handy, and being ready to move.
Good evening, Liza.
Minnesotans can be sure to check what is and isn't allowed in checked and carry-on luggage on TSA.gov. For North Star Stories, I'm Juma Jama.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Initiative Foundation has awarded $100,000 in grants to 18 rural food shelves across central Minnesota. The goal is to help under-resourced food shelves manage rising demand as food costs climb. Foundation leaders say the funding will provide immediate relief for organizations that serve as essential lifelines in their communities. Food shelves report seeing more visitors, including older adults on fixed incomes. The grants will help purchase fresh produce, dairy products, and other essentials.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Devontae Hines, who performs as Blood Orange, is a true musical polymath. He's composed classical symphonies, scored Hollywood films, and produced and performed hits in genres ranging from experimental R&B to pop punk and indie folk. I can go. Now he's out with a brand new Blood Orange album. It's called Essex Honey, and it mines from his childhood growing up in Essex, a county just east of London.
I'm always very much intrigued by working through memory, the corners of memory, like the almost like the unreliable narrator, looking at what I can remember and the emotions of various situations in growing up.
It's Hines' first studio album since 2018's Negro Swan. During that stretch of time, there was the pandemic, then his mother got sick, and he spent time at home in Essex with her until her death in 2023.
As much as it explores family and Essex and England and grief, it's also looking at a constant of all of this, which is music.
When I spoke with Dev Hines, I asked him about how all of his experiences, from early life influences to the more recent loss of his mother, shaped the album.
It's a lot of questions. It's a lot of darkness. It's a lot of the realities of, I guess, trauma and death and grief. The realities of depression. You know, the biggest shock, I think, that I think happens to people when something very bad happens is the realization that the world is still moving. This horrible thing has happened, but the world is still moving. People are still going out for lunch. And so in this album, I think that's something that is happening. There could be these moments where it feels like it's about to get up. But then you kind of get dragged back down again. You know, you haven't fully lost the memory of the reality.
A specific song on this album that you wrote after her death, or one that reflects on that experience?
Lyrically, the whole album is quite literal. I really, really wanted to write literal lyrics. I wanted it to be very precise and direct, because I've always felt that the more precise and specific you are, it suddenly becomes way more universal, because you get to the root of the emotion, and the emotion is the thing that people can relate to. Nothing more to do but leave. I think it sounds metaphorical. There's a line that talks about a knitted heart that was given to me. It's real. The hospital gives you these tiny little knitted hearts when you lose someone. Knitted heart they gave to me. I would say Vivid Light is pretty much direct about, I guess, immediate emotions following.
If I remember correctly, this is the song that author Zadie Smith makes an appearance on. Is that right?
Yes, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about working with her and why you asked her to be a part of this record?
Yeah, so kind of like everyone else on the album, she's a friend, and she was
She was visiting back in New York, and she then just came by my apartment because she wanted to hear what I was working on. And I played her that song, and really, I basically just shoved a mic in her hand because she's always singing, and she has an incredible voice.
Did you have to do much convincing to get her to sing on this album?
No. I mean, she loves singing way more than I do. I guess that's not that hard.
But singing in your kitchen or singing in your living room is different than singing on an album that everybody's going to hear and consume.
I guess so, but she was still singing in my living room.
Fair point. Much in the same way of your other Blood Orange albums, you have this long list of collaborators on Essex Honey, including Caroline Polachek, Lorde, Brendan Yates from Turnstile, Zadie Smith, to name a few. What is it that you get out of working with so many different musicians on your albums?
It's the conversation. I just love conversation. And I love talking to friends. I'm trying to just, in my own view, make the best things that I can do. And what that then allows is the door to be completely open, because this combination of wanting to see what I can do, but also wanting to make something that is the best in my own eyes, means that I can open the door to friends. And if they have an idea and in my eyes, it is a better idea, then incredible. We're getting somewhere. Caroline added on, there's a song called Mind Loaded, and the vocal she added really, I mean, that song had existed for me for quite a long time, and I'd been working on it on and off, and then towards the end of the process she added this like really incredible, almost like counter melody over the I guess their verses, I don't even know, but she added something over them, and it was so next level, something I could never have ever thought of, but something that only Caroline could ever have thought of. To me, that's the perfect example of why it's always so cool to bring people in.
Now, your last full-length studio album is Blood Orange was out back in 2018, and you released a mixtape, Angel's Pulse, in 2019. What has changed, if anything, about the way that you release music since those releases?
Oh, God, so much. It's awful now.
Why? What makes it awful?
I mean, it's so intense. Like the noise. There's so much noise out there in the world, and everyone is fighting for attention, and then they're fighting for attention for it to get lost in an algorithm. It's a little too crazy for me. All of it just makes you want to be as direct as possible, as self-aware as possible. Just, I don't want to be like, hey, look, I'm cool. Like, I don't want to do any of that. I don't know, I'm 39. Like, I just, I don't think it's, for myself, really that fitting. You know, the reality is that I make music, and I'm very, very fortunate that people want to listen to it. And so if I can do that literal thing, I don't know, I feel like I've done what I need to do.
We've been speaking with Devontae Hines, who performs as Blood Orange. His new album, Essex Honey, is out now. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, thank you.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states, whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bangley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Power Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, offering music lessons and art programming for all ages. More at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and Instagram. United Way of 1000 Lakes hosts the Lumberjack Mile and 5K Saturday, September 6th. Registration at 8 a.m., race at 9 a.m. at Grand Rapids Public Utilities. Proceeds benefit the United Way School Pantry Coalition, a network of 11 schools addressing student hunger